Wow. That was... You know, last time we had a conversation like that on our show...
They hung up on us.
No. Last time we had a conversation like that on our show, it was Tariq Fatah and Andy Kindler.
Here's what I've
just figured out. If you're from the Middle East, that's how you discuss things.
Yes.
There's a little giddy up to them.
There is.
You know what I mean?
But the feel wasn't from the Middle East. He's Pakistani.
Well, okay.
I don't know, maybe it's...
What I'm saying is they're not Canadian,
the mentality.
All right, listen, folks.
Blame it on the foreigners.
You're
That's
listening
it.
To the
That's
Drew...
That's it. Thank you, Mr. Trump. Welcome to the Drew Trump Show.
You're listening to the Drew Trump Show. That's my name. Tim the Tool over here. Megan the intern sorting out cables and all sorts of things, falling asleep in the corner over there. It's time for the pub crawl on a show. We haven't had this in quite a while, so I'm looking forward to it. I told Megs we were doing it today, and she was excited because this is the kind of stuff we like to talk about on our show. Frank Schaefer is back on the Drew Marshall Show. Frank Schaefer is a New York Times bestselling author of more than a dozen books. Frank is a survivor of both polio and an evangelical fundamentalist childhood, an acclaimed writer who overcame severe dyslexia, a homeschooled and self-taught documentary movie director, a feature film director of four low-budget Hollywood features, and Frank has described them as pretty terrible. He's on the phone with us right now, frankschaefer.com. Frank, what's going on, man? How are you?
You need to update my profile.
Well, I'm not. I didn't read the whole thing. I don't want to go through the whole thing.
You got to add the most salient point you left out. I also am the only guest who willingly appears on your show without being bribed, blackmailed, or bullied.
You are the lucky one.
Wow.
Your listeners don't know what happens to people who refuse to show up.
Nor will they ever find out.
Yes.
Nor will they ever find out. We haven't heard from Eric Metaxas lately.
No.
I wonder what's happening with him.
Well, there's that new speed bump in the parking lot.
Stop it.
Yeah, he's probably Donald Trump's water boy.
Yes, he is. He is. He totally is. Lillian Daniel, when spiritual but not religious is not enough, seeing God in surprising places, even the church is a provocative case for why religious community matters. This much-talked-about book has been described as biting, hilarious, pitch-perfect, tender, and often stunningly beautiful, much like Lillian Daniel herself. Hello, Lillian.
Oh, my goodness.
Come on! That was a great intro. That was a great intro. Hey, listen, Lillian, have you ever spoken to Frank Schaefer before?
Never. I'm very happy to meet you, Frank.
Hey, Lillian, nice to meet you. Where are you, by the way?
I'm sitting with my cat in Iowa.
Sitting with my cat in Iowa. Dun, dun,
dun, dun. And I got her declawed.
Frank, where are you?
I am sitting with my rabid raccoon in Massachusetts.
You mean the only conservative that's in Massachusetts? Okay, got it. Guys, you both have lots to say in these issues, so we got to get stuck right into this. We just finished an hour of Jihadi Jenga on the Drew Marshall Show with two gentlemen who wrote books about jihadis. So let's get into our version of jihadi. Mark Driscoll, controversial former Mars Hill Church pastor Mark Driscoll. Some of you have heard about Mark Driscoll. Some of you may not have heard about Mark Driscoll. When was the last thing you heard about Mark Driscoll, Lillian? Do you know anything about him at all?
Yeah, well, obviously I heard that he had gotten the boot from his church and was starting a new one. But I never could get a handle on what exactly he had done wrong that resulted in him losing the church.
Right.
It would fill me in.
Well, former Mars Hill megachurch pastor Mark Driscoll is launching his new church this Easter Sunday. In the meantime, Mark Driscoll is being sued for soliciting donations for one reason and then using that money for other reasons. Back in October 2014, he resigned from one of the largest megachurches in the States because of allegations of plagiarism, abusive behavior, and just being a general D-bag. Later that year, the church closed their 15 campuses. So some are saying, Frank, at this point in time, that Mark Driscoll should not be, being a pastor again. He shouldn't be starting up a church. It's too soon. How soon is too soon? And does it depend on what you did? Does it depend on what your restorative journey has been? Because as outsiders, Frank, we wouldn't know what his restorative journey has been like. Are we too judgy on Mark Driscoll? Should we let him start a new church? I don't think we have a say in it, but how do you feel about it?
Hey, it can't be soon enough. Listen, there's a whole world of progressive religious bloggers out there who have basically lost their income since he quit. There was no one to make fun of and criticize. We have to get him back.
That's true. That's
like a whole world. There's a whole world of self-righteous liberals like me who just need Mark Driscoll. We need him. So he should come back. He should steal all the money. He should go to bed with all the women.
Yeah.
Then he should start abusing young people. But he's got to do it while he's hugely successful. I want his church to grow to at least 70,000.
Yes, yes, that makes
100,000
makes good sense.
And then, then we have something back to write about.
Wow. You know, I didn't think I'd get that kind of response from Crazy Frank. That's your new nickname on the show, by the way, Crazy Frank. Lillian, you know, you're pretty good at sort of saying, what business is of ours? Like, why should we care about this? Do you feel the same way about this Mark Driscoll stuff?
You know, yeah. I mean, I think every time Christians get out front and act judgmental, you know, another angel in heaven gets a migraine. And, so I do think that, you know, the people who already hate Mark Driscoll are not going to go to his church, and there's always going to be people who are willing to go. And when we sort of jump up and down and say, you know, oh, who is he? It sort of looks like we're jealous, I think, as clergy, you know? And that was the thing with all the...
It doesn't look like it. We are jealous.
We are jealous. That's what you're saying, Frank.
No, I don't know. I can't speak for we, because I'm not a clergy. I'm a writer living in Massachusetts, a long way from clergy anything. But I do think there is. I mean, I was being facetious, obviously.
Sure.
In all seriousness, of course, he should never get back into any of this, because the whole thing is a crock. It's not a question of, look, there's some great guys running mega churches who we all want to emulate and be like, and then there are these crooks or semi-crooks or people who get in trouble. The problem is a lot deeper than that, and it has nothing to do with whether someone has personal integrity, as in not stealing or sleeping with the help or abusing their wife or whatever it is. It has to do with our idea of what spirituality and what I call the intrinsic worth of beauty is worth to us. So if spirituality is about growth and numbers and rah, 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 then, you know, some Donald Trump version of Christianity, then, you know, a Mark Driscoll makes perfectly good sense, whether he's, you know, successful or ripping people off isn't the point. The point is, what is our idea of spirituality? What is our idea of Christianity? What is our idea of trying to follow Jesus? This is a whole different question. So I don't think Mark Driscoll's problem was that he went off the rails and broke his own rules and was a total hypocrite. I think his problem was much deeper than that, and that is he was a real fist-in-your-face, blood-in-your-eye, reformed Calvinist of the kind that really, you know, in the movie I was in that your great Canadian filmmaker made called Hellbound? Where Mark Driscoll was interviewed, and I was another person in it, and so was Brian McLaren and other Canadian theologians and so forth and so on. You know, he was saying, yeah, you know, most of the human race is going to hell. God's love involves creating people expressly to judge them. This kind of hard-assed view that, you know, we're all familiar with through the American Reconstruction movement, like Rush Dooney and all these other people who wanted to create theocracies. That's the problem. I don't care if he stole the money. What I care about is this horrible, horrible, horrible blasphemy against Jesus Christ by portraying salvation as this hard-assed, exclusionary, mean-spirited kind of religion where, you know, God is a complete jerk and anybody you meet is nicer than the Creator. So that's the problem. The problem isn't what he did in his church. So he should never open his doors anywhere and preach that gospel of hate. So whether he steals money
I disagree. I mean, I think, you know, I think part of the tradition of the church is we've always had different streams, and many of them are sort of distasteful or boring or tedious or what have you. And, you know, I couldn't sit through his sermons, but I still would sort of affirm his right to, you know, to do his thing. And what is so mysterious, though, is these people who flock to the church and want to listen to that judgmental, mean-spirited, hateful stuff, then turn around and fire him because guess what? It turns out he's kind of judgmental and mean-spirited and hateful himself.
Right. Good point.
Like, yeah, it was almost like that. That probably got him the job in the first place. So, yeah, it seems a bit mysterious. And I think when we get all up in arms, you're absolutely right. There's so many bloggers who make their living, sort of outraged with each other. You know, like, no, Mark Driscoll hurt my feelings even more than he hurt yours.
So on the phone with us is Frank Schaefer and Lillian Daniel, and we've just been chatting about Mark Driscoll, the fact that he's an ex-Mars Hill pastor. The whole Mars Hill thing collapsed when he was sort of, you know, found out that he was kind of an abusive jerk and a little plagiaristic. And anyway, there are lots of things. And look, I think both of you made, as I hoped you would, fantastic points. About it's not about whether he did these things. It's about setting up that particular tribe of Christendom in such a way that I think we end up worshiping the pastor as opposed to worshiping the God that the pastor is talking about. I think there's a huge issue there that needs to be torn down. And that leads us actually to this next question as well, because we've got two megachurch scenarios here. Megachurch pastor Andy Stanley. So have a listen to this clip, and you tell me what you think about this, folks. Have a listen. This is Andy Stanley.
The church, for me, has provided some of my lifelong friendships. And you know what's fabulous? The church has done the same thing for my kids. My kids' best friends right now, most of my kids' best friends were friends they met at church. And at school, but mostly at church. And the kids that they went to church and school with, they are their dear friends all the way through high school and college. And for many of your kids, this is the same, this is true as well. For me, some of my closest adult friends are adults that I've met not in rows, but in circles. Because we say circles are better than rows, because in circles you have actual community. And it's been in community and community groups that Sandra and I have made some lifelong friends. That would not have happened for me. That would not have happened for us as a couple, apart from the local church. Now, this is one reason we build big churches. People say, why do you have to make them so big? Let me tell you why we make them so big. You probably didn't know this. This is kind of an insider secret. We want churches to be large enough so that there are enough middle schoolers and high schoolers that we don't have one youth group with middle school and high school together. We want there to be so many adults that there will be so many middle school and high school kids that we can have two separate environments. So when I hear adults say, well, I don't like a big church. I like about 200. I want to be able to know everybody. I say, you are so stinking selfish. You care nothing about the next generation. All you care about is you and your five friends. You don't care about your kids. Anybody else's kids are like, what's up? I'm saying, if you don't go to a church large enough, come on, if you don't go to a church large enough where you can have enough middle schoolers and high schoolers to separate them so they can have small groups and grow up the local church, you are a selfish adult. Get over it. Find yourself a big old church where your kids can connect with a bunch of people and grow up and love the local church. Instead, what you do, can you tell I'm passionate about this? Yeah. Here's what you do. I mean, I'm so sick of this. I hear this all the time. Well, I just don't like a big church. Well, okay, look, so here's what you do. You drag your kids to a church they hate, and then they grow up and hate the local church, and then they go off to college. And you know what you pray for? You pray there will be a church in their college town that they connect with. And guess what? All those churches are big. The kind of church you don't like. So let me move on. Let me just say this. Parents, don't attend a church that teaches your children to hate church.
Okay. There you go, folks. I didn't want to misquote him, so we played the entire clip. Megachurch pastor Andy Stanley said that basically parents who want to go to a smaller church are selfish and don't care about their kids. And now he has since apologized, okay? And he actually, I think he did a pretty decent job apologizing, especially when you put his apology in contrast with Mark Driscoll's apologies over the years. But did he go too far? He says he went too far. But does he actually have a little point here at all? Lillian, I'll let you go first on this one. Does he have a little bit of a point? You know those people that want to just have their kids go to the small little church and they force them to go and the church is boring and then the kids hate church and they go to college and get swallowed up by Satan. Does he have a point?
No, I think, to me, the kind of church I would hate is the kind of church where they put all this effort into, like, getting six times as many middle schoolers there. Like, that is not a fun group to spend time with.
Like, way too many middle schoolers.
Yeah, I'm just like, and where did the gospel, you know, it's just like, okay, and so the reason we have these big churches, and I'm thinking, is to reach lots of people with the love of Christ. It's like, so that we don't have to combine the middle schoolers and the high schoolers Because, you know, Jesus talks a lot about that pedagogically, like the importance of separating middle schoolers from high schoolers. What?
All right. Look, when it comes to this sort of thinking, this is not... He actually, when he says in that little spiel, he says, can you tell I'm venting? To me, when someone's venting, that's when their real stuff comes out. And so he apologized for it. Okay, I get that. But there's some kind of vitriolic truth in what he was saying. Do you not think, Frank?
But here's what I... But wait, I do find it somewhat refreshing to hear a minister vent a little bit about the way they're doing church and that they really believe in it. I feel like most clergy are so afraid of offending anybody that they just bend over backwards, you know, so they're like, yeah, I have a mega church, but sure, I think it's just as good if you go to a church with, you know, four people. And you know that's not true.
Right.
I mean, I appreciate he's passionate about what he's doing.
Okay, so one check mark for Andy Stanley. Frank?
You know, Drew, the only reason I hate coming on this show is because you do things like this to me. You play hours and hours of these clips, and then I'm just sitting here saying, I don't know what to say to this. It's like you're going to talk about Donald Trump, and then if you play clips of his, I was having a pretty decent afternoon here.
With your pet raccoon.
With you and your raccoon.
Until you tricked me by saying you're going to be on a radio show, and really you wanted to torture me.
Yeah, sorry.
Playing these clips. You wanted to torture me. Because, listen, let me tell you my reaction to that clip. Again, it's a little off the mark here. It's not to do with church size or anything else, other than I'm very happy that 30 years ago I had good enough sense to leave the evangelical big God business community entirely, and that I don't have to live in a world anymore where we're strategizing on how to fill churches. But, you know, I think of my own grandchildren. Listen, you know, I got five grandkids, and because I got my wife pregnant when we were 17 and 18, two of them are in their early 20s. But the three that live across the street, literally on my block, are 5, 7, and 2. And I take them to my little Greek Orthodox church every Sunday, you know, and if we're lucky, there's like 150 people there. What they like about the church is that it is part of our community. It is 5 minutes from our house. When we walk on the sidewalk, we meet Stella, who swoops up Lucy, who's 7, and kisses her and takes her in to buy her a milkshake somewhere. And when we walk around town and it's an icy day, we see some of the older people who are in our church and we'll stop and help them out to get across the ice. The church is not an isolated experience like going to a movie theater or rah-rah, it's big or small. It's part of the fact that I believe in community, and I believe in continuity, and I believe in sticking with the wife I married 45 years ago and all the rest of it. It's a philosophy of life that doesn't put a premium on measuring success by money or spirituality by size or dynamism by how many people you can con into coming into a building every Sunday to give you money. It has to do with the continuity of all of life. So this whole business about, you know, what are kids going to grow up, hate church, not hate church, the real point here is if they're in a community where they are experiencing unconditional love from all ages, by the way, I hate this idea of young people's groups and all the rest. I love the fact that in an old liturgy, everybody's in church together. You know, 90-year-olds on walkers and babies in their mother's arms. That's, to me, what it looks like. But that's just personal.
And it turns out,
so, again, I look at this and I don't hear some strategy to judge or not judge. It's just a world I don't want any part of.
Right. Right, Lillian?
Drew, in all seriousness, though, I mean, I am a parent and I've, you know, and of course all of us have lived through the middle school years. And I think those are actually some of the most painful years in American culture. I mean, kids can be horrible to each other and the bullying and all of that. And one of the things they've actually looked at, and this is research on the mainline and the evangelical side, is to find out that these sort of segregated by age groups, you know, youth groups, don't actually produce a mature, long-lasting faith. What makes the difference is intergenerational love, the kind that Frank was sharing. And, you know, I was listening to one talk, and this came out of Fuller Seminary. These are the evangelicals. And she's saying that, you know, taking the kids off and playing the fruit game in the basement or whatever you do with, you know, kids exactly your age does not then produce a mature adult who has a theological explanation for cancer hitting a good person. You know, that happens through that mentoring. And she was even talking about a ratio of 5 adults who care for every one child and know that kid's name over time.
Interesting.
That's youth ministry that works.
Huh. Well, okay.
I love that point. I love that point. And it brings up something, just to share one tiny anecdote, and I won't go on about this. But
yes, you will.
One of the most meaningful, yes, I will. One of the most things that I love most is coming up toward Easter on Good Friday. The older women in the church get together and they decorate a wooden tomb that is like Christ's tomb that then gets carried around as part of the service. It's a very ancient liturgy. Lucy, since she's been three, has been included in this group where the median age is probably 83. And she literally looks forward to it all year and talks about it. You know how a kid is, if you do something twice, it's a tradition. She's already asking about it. Will I be able to decorate the Epitaphio again? Will you bring me early enough so I can be with them? Here's a seven-year-old little girl whose best friends are 80-year-old women, and the event of her year is working for 3 or 4 hours, and they let her help cut the flowers and put all this together. That's to me what that experience looks like. It isn't some clever youth group that makes her want to be cool or whatever it is for Jesus. It's the relationship with all these wonderful people.
Okay, the thing that I took out of that whole Andy Stanley spiel was the fact that he and his wife are so socially retarded that they need the church to have friends. Yeah. That's what I got.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that is the true purpose of the church, is to provide friends for pastors, you know, who would never otherwise have any.
Yeah. Well, it's an awkward, awkward thing. Now, listen.
But also, can you, listen, let me say one more thing, Ryan, because I do think when we take the youth out of the picture of the larger church and sort of imply that certain people are experts at youth ministry, I think it's really absurd. And if you did it with another age group, it would sound crazy. So, like, if I were interviewing for a job as a pastor, and I said, you know what, I love people of all ages, but when it comes to people in their 50s, I'm no good with them. And between the ages of 50 and 60, I think they should leave church, go in the basement, play special games that 50-year-olds
Amen.
Like.
Amen. Amen. I agree.
You know, we'll bring them back in, and, oh, we're shocked that they don't like church.
Yep. I think you have just come up with a new concept for church, Lily, and I like this. I like this. Actually, I just heard something recently. There's a guy, I can't remember his name. He just started a once-a-month church. Jim
Henson.
Church.
Jim Henson.
Jim Henson, that's right.
I have no idea.
No, that's who it is.
Really?
Yeah,
Muppet
they
guy?
Have the same name. It's a different guy. Anyway.
Hey, Kermit the Frog here.
Lily, what do you think about once-a-month church?
I think that I've pastored three of them.
You've pastored three once-a-month churches? Why, are you saying no one came out except once a month?
Yeah, I mean, seriously, that's, you know, worship attendance is so interesting. People will check off on a survey that they are very regular in their attendance if they come twice a month. And, you know, in their mind, over a span of 10 years, they've been to church, you know, once a month. It feels like they are highly involved. That is sort of the new discovery, you know, in looking at these surveys and stuff.
Oh, I'm looking across here at Tim. He wants to say something. Yes, Tim?
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm sort of torn here. I've got a relatively small church with some very strong youth presence, but I also need to say that it is a challenge from a pedagogical point of view, teaching point of view, that five-year-olds are not going to be able to comprehend the same things that adults were, and we do need to approach them slightly differently. So it does sound bad that we're sending kids to the basement, but I don't know if they necessarily would get anything at all.
So yeah, staying forcing with them
so
to stay
there
in
is,
church.
There is a challenge. There is a tension.
But I don't think
the
either
two.
Of these guys are saying,
no,
send the kids out to learn
maybe,
something.
Maybe
in a
they should
way.
Join us for once a month church.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you don't send them out at 5 and then don't let them back in again until they're 18.
No, and that's the challenge, of course.
All right, I don't want to talk about this anymore because neither of these
hey,
subjects...
I'm going to jump in. I want to say one more thing.
Yeah,
first of all, I loved that idea of sending the 50-year-olds to the basement. I think we should all try that and make them play games. I don't know why that strikes me as so good, but I really believe it. Maybe that's my age bracket, and I want to go to the basement and be forced to play games.
That's
so
creepy.
That,
that's
and
just
I'll come
creepy.
To your church.
Okay.
Okay, that is creepy, but okay, that's one thing. But in seriousness, again, one of the reasons that I like a liturgically strong tradition, and it has nothing to do with right or wrong or getting to heaven. I'm just talking taste here. It's like saying I like Miles Davis. You know, it's not right or wrong. Is that when I look at my grandchildren and how they've grown up in this Orthodox Greek little community of ours, as opposed to my memories of church, which was sermons plus hymns, emphasis on sermons. So you're sitting there listening to a long sermon or you're trying to come up with some activity. You know, what I love about a liturgical tradition is there's so many physical things to do which can be taken by a 5-year-old or by a 60-year-old on different levels, but are equally relevant. You know, a monk once told me, I said to him, well, why in the Orthodox Church do you give communion to newborn babies who don't even know what it is? And his answer to me was, look me right in the eye and says, well, do you?
Whoa, whoa,
so
snap.
When you get to the actual mysteries of faith, which in, say, in the Orthodox Church might involve kissing an icon, lighting a candle, being baptized, wandering around the back of the church during the service, processions during the liturgy. You know, a 5-year-old likes a liturgical procession just as much as a 50-year-old. My 2-year-old little Nora loves to light the candles and helps the old guy in the narthex take out the candles that have burnt down. She goes out every Sunday, gives her a little job, and she puts them in the box after he dips them in water so we don't burn our church down again the way we did 30 years ago.
So tradition.
Tradition must be, yeah, no, it's every 40 years you got to burn your
church. Okay, yes, all right.
Get it straight, Tim. Jeez.
You have to get the 6-year-olds in the basement out first. We forgot last time. Sadly, we lost, you know, a couple people. But
Frank!
Whoa,
Frank!
Man,
Frank, hold on, dude! Did you just say your church burnt down and people died, and you're serious?
No, I'm not serious.
Oh,
I'm serious,
man!
About the church burned down, but we didn't lose anything.
Man, Frank Schaefer, ladies and gentlemen, that's where you send your hate mail to, frankschaefer.com. He's used to it. He's a fan of the Drew Marshall Show. All right, listen.
Hey, so listen, no. But what? In all seriousness, if it's all teaching based instead of doing,
yeah.
Whether that's coffee hour or whatever. You know, I love to go down and see the Sunday school for the 12-year-olds because what they always do is go into coffee hour and bake for next Sunday. And while they're baking together and cooking in the kitchen, the wonderful woman who teaches them is teaching them and telling them about liturgical and biblical tradition. It doesn't all have to be sit and listen to some guy drone on.
Well said. Well said.
Frank, it sounds like you've got some child labor.
Yeah, he does.
Grandchildren, yes.
But that's not as big a problem as locking the 6-year-old in the basement. Wait a minute, I hear them whining. I'm going to go down and throw some more meat down.
Okay, you guys should never meet. Ever, okay? Just promise me that. Lillian, Daniel on the phone, and Frank Schaefer as well. All right, let's get to our third and final topic. Apparently, America is a Christian nation, so I've heard. So American Christians tend to vote for the candidate who is most forthright about their faith. That I think that's the case. I wouldn't know. I'm Canadian. GOP candidate Donald Trump claims to be a Christian and has talked about it. And so what kind of a predicament is the Christian population in the States in right now? Television evangelist Joel Osteen has he isn't officially signed off, I don't think, on Trump, but he has not denied that he is a good friend of theirs and friend of the ministry, which I means cash has been sent their way. I don't know. And Jerry Falwell Jr. has endorsed Donald Trump. The Pope has not endorsed Donald Trump. So who would Jesus endorse is a cheeky question, and I don't think Jesus would endorse anybody. So that's not the real question. The real question is, what do we do when someone, I think generally we could look at Mr. Trump and say, nutcase. We could look at him and then go, okay, now, but he's a Christian. So then we go, well, hold on. Is he a Christian? Does a Christian? The Pope says he's not a Christian because a Christian wouldn't be about walls. And then we start trying to read into his spiritual journey. And is he real? And so what are the Jesus people supposed to do, Frank? Frank, what are the Jesus people supposed to do when it comes to Trump?
Oh, my goodness. You know, see, I told you tortured your guest. Let me just say this. You know, having as you know, sadly, been part of the formation of the religious right in the 70s and 80s, my father, Francis Schaefer, and I, along with Sievert Koop and Ronald Reagan and a whole bunch of other people, used the pro-life movement when it first came into being as a means to get a lot of evangelicals who were not voting much and very apathetic into the political mainstream, and we unknowingly contributed to creating the beginnings of the religious right, which I've written about in my memoir, Crazy for God, as you know, we've talked about it.
Yes.
Looking back on that, you know, if I was just going to put a checklist on the wall that gets us to your question today, we were running around doing what we were doing in the 70s and 80s, and all of a sudden, you know, elections become about corralling the evangelical vote, and so Ronald Reagan, who was pro-choice, becomes pro-life. I introduced him on the stage of the Religious Broadcasters Convention one year, along with Pat Robertson, and what we all got going then turns into talk radio, and then turns into Fox News, and then turns into the far-right taking over America to the point where we get George W. Bush and he starts a war in Iraq and on and on and on it goes. And now we come down to this thing where this bloated billionaire, braggart, proven liar, and these are not words I would ever have used about anybody else in politics, ever. I mean, this is a unique case. He is running around, obviously, very much on the outside of any religious community whatsoever, claiming to be an evangelical as he seeks the endorsement from Jerry Falwell Jr., whose father's pulpit I preached from twice at Liberty Baptist, who 3 weeks before he induced Trump asked his student body to begin to carry loaded firearms, as he does on campus, to protect themselves against Muslims. This is so far away from where we were in the 70s, running around trying to save babies. Forget the abortion issue for a minute, but that's what it was about then. The trajectory's now gone so far that it just boggles my mind. You know, I'm sitting here on the cusp of being 64 years old saying, I think I've gone to another planet. I mean, there's no way to describe what's going on. It's so far and away further than anything you could have imagined. So that's my take on it, and I can't help waxing historical because I see a progression of events here that is just, you know, when religion becomes part of politics, it's deadly. Anyway, everywhere, anywhere in history. And this is just, this goes from deadly to a wicked farce. I mean, it's just a farce to think of Donald Trump talking about anything religious.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, Frank, thank you for that. Lillian, what are the Jesus people supposed to do when it comes to vote time if Donald Trump is the one that said, I love Jesus more than everybody else?
So the first thing the Jesus people should not do is sit around making pronouncements about who's a Jesus person and who's not. You know, that is fundamentally at odds with what Jesus did and said. So I think that, you know, as tempting as it is to get up on our high horse and say, well, he says he's a Christian, but he's not because he's done this or that wrong. We're not going to have anybody. You know, we're not going to have anybody. And it really is that the people outside the church who've never been part of a religious community, when they point at people in the church and say, oh, look, that person did something wrong. The church is full of hypocrites. I'm not going to go. It's like people who, you know, go to the gym and say, oh, there's overweight people here. I'm not going to go to the gym. You know, it doesn't work. Like, the church is full of human beings who screw up. And I think that whenever Christians are tempted to kick each other out of the club, we just make ourselves look like jerks, particularly to people who are outside the church.
Okay, so we're not making a pronouncement as to the eternal destination of Donald Trump. But Jesus people still want to vote for someone that talks about God stuff. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, you all are Americans. I'm just a Canuck. Is it not the Don who's talked more about God stuff than any other GOP candidate?
I don't know that
Cruz is
Cruz. It's pretty wacky. I mean, it's pretty wacky.
Who, Cruz's take on Jesus stuff is wacky, too?
Well, I mean,
it depends on your definition of wacky. But, I mean, yeah. Put it this way. It would be like out in the ozone layer orbiting if it was a jet.
Right. Okay, thanks. Yeah. Thanks for clarifying that. Okay, so honestly, do you think the United States will ever get to a point where a Muslim will become president? Lillian, you go first.
Well, I think if we put, you know, Frank Schaefer and all his buddies who started the religious right on it, it could happen.
Nice.
I'm working on it, but we're not getting very far.
No, not getting very far at all.
President Obama's a Muslim.
Yes, that's right. There was no birth certificate and all that. Yeah,
well, that
okay.
was Donald Trump, yeah, of
yeah,
course.
Yeah.
I very much hope that we could have a person of any faith or even no faith, and I think that's probably what we're going to see before a Muslim is elected president, is somebody, you know, maybe like a Bernie Sanders sometimes comes off or others who says, you know, I'm spiritual but not religious, because that is probably the majority of people in the United States. So that's probably what we're going to see. And I think it's healthy. I don't know anybody who, when forced to talk about their deepest questions about eternity and life and death and God as part of a political campaign, I don't know of anybody who produces anything worth listening to or anything of much depth. And I think it's inappropriate to go there and to badger people about this.
Okay. All right. So what I hear you saying is, who cares about Donald Trump's spirituality? Did I get that right?
No. I mean, I care about it, right? Like, I might have my own opinions, but I think that when particularly when Christians who don't agree with Trump stand up and suddenly become like these weird fundamentalists about Christianity and say he's not a Christian, we just sound nutty. It's not who we are.
Right, right. As far as Canadians are concerned, we have tightened up our border security immensely since things have been going a little strange down there in the United States. We're prepared for an influx of y'all coming up to our
neighborhood. You should build a wall. You should build a wall and make us pay for it.
Yes, that's exactly it. That's exactly it. Okay, I want to give each of you just a little plug time. Frank, I know you're a walking plug machine, so tell me what's happening. Give me a little tidbit about the latest, greatest book that's coming out of you.
I was just sitting here thinking, you know, I have forgotten to plug my book. What have I spent this hour doing? Why did I bother? I'm getting all discouraged thinking, well, crap, I've got a bad cold. I must be sicker than I think.
Yeah, yeah.
I forgot to plug my book. So the plug time is that I have got a book, as you know, that is still my latest book, called Why I Am an Atheist Who Believes in God. And what it is about is my own journey towards embracing paradox when it comes to what I regard as my former certainty addiction as someone who grew up in a more fundamentalist community. And I get a lot of very interesting email, speaking of people from all different backgrounds, from all kinds of backgrounds or none, including the atheist community. And I wrote that after I got an exchange of emails. Well, I had an exchange of emails and a couple of phone calls with the late atheist author Christopher Hitchens, who liked my memoir, Crazy for God, and started writing to me, asking questions. And one day he emailed me and said, well, I just got to the end of your book and I'm very disappointed because you didn't make a clear declaration that you're now an atheist and you still seem to be someone who's somewhat of a person in faith, because I talked about going to the Greek Orthodox Church.
Right.
And I would get similar emails from evangelicals saying, we're disappointed because we finished reading Crazy for God and you didn't clearly affirm you're still a Christian. And I was thinking, isn't it interesting if you change the subject line on the email and a word or two, it's the same criticism. And so I essentially wrote Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God to try to answer what I consider this kind of labeling certainty addiction that we have in wanting to know exactly where people are coming from, when really real life isn't like that. And one thing I talk about in Why I'm an Atheist Who Believes in God is that we don't do that to words like love. I mean, how do you define love? Sometimes after a big fight with my wife, love means that day, you know, when we reconcile, we hate each other a little less than we did in the morning. Another day, it's bringing her a cup of coffee in bed or having a good sexual relationship. Love can mean a lot of different things. So it seems crazy to me when we get to issues like God and faith that we demand these cookie-cutter explanations. So that's what the book is about. That's my plug. Thank you for the commercial break.
Ladies and gentlemen, Frank Schaefer on
well
the Drew Marshall
well
Show.
Done.
Yeah, very well done, Frank. All right, Lillian, your turn. Double down.
All right. Hey, well, my big news is I'm serving a new church in Dubuque, Iowa.
Well, that doesn't help us. That doesn't help us want to send you money or buy stuff,
but just once a month, right?
All right. But okay. So then, I do have a new book coming out in September, and it's called "Tired of Apologizing for a Church I Don't Belong to."
Ooh.
And
like
then
it
has, you know, it's got to have the colon and the subtitle because then people know you're smart.
Right.
So there's like a colon, and then it says, spirituality without stereotypes, religion without ranting.
That's a good-looking colon.
Mm.
But really, yeah, it's in some ways it is me ranting, and what I'm ranting about is the sloppy ways people talk about religion, and a lot of them being on the atheist side, you know. And so people say things like, oh, you know, how can you go to church? Religion is responsible for all the wars in recent history.
Yeah.
You know, and they want, and I think a lot of times open-minded Christians are like, oh, yeah, thanks, that's a really good point, you know, and the Salem witch trials, like, I'm so sorry about that, you know, and the Inquisition, like, I'm against it. And, you know, to that, I'm tired of that. I think we have to sort of push back and say, like, wow, stop stereotyping my religion. And, you know, I'm tired of apologizing for church I don't belong to.
Ladies and gentlemen, Lillian Daniel on the Drew Marshall Show. Lillian, well done. Very good pitch. Well, I like both of you, and I've always wanted to have both of you on the show at the same time. Now I can die. Frank Schaefer, frankschaefer.com, that's the website you want to go to. Lillian Daniel, oddly enough, lilliandaniel.com is the website you want to go to. Both intelligent, thoughtful, and lovely human beings. I really appreciate both you guys weighing in on these topics today, because it was very Americana today, and I don't know what's going on down there. So thank you, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Drew. And Frank, pleasure to get to be with you.
Yeah, no, it was nice. You know, I'll come out there sometime. I'd like to meet you one of these days.
You mean to meet me in Toronto or meet her in Iowa?
No, I'm not going to meet you, Drew. I'm not going to Canada to meet you, Drew. I'm going to her new church in Dubuque.
All right.
I'm going to sell her congregation of three people locked in the basement a book.
Yes. Well done. All right, guys. You take care. Goodbye to both of you. A short break, and when we come back, I will be able to break down what kind of coffee you drink based on what kind of theology you believe. Stay with us.
But Daniel was hot. He drew fast and shot. And Rocky collapsed in the corner.